Before we begin today's episode, I'd like to say a few words about our lovely sponsors. The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication which contains both academic articles and lighter, more entertaining reading for all kinds of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal or how to subscribe, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com. The Scintillation of Sion is an annual symposium held in Maryland, USA for fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box, and if you'd like to know more about the next event, their website is www.scintillation.org. Wessex Press, which is an imprint of Gastgene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
The following interview was recorded live at ElementaryCon in Birmingham.
Morning, everyone. Well, that was really crap. Morning, everyone.
Morning.
Come on, you've got to shout really loudly because apparently there's 800 of you wandering around this place. So I want them to hear the noise and come through those doors like the sheep that they are. Once they hear this noise, and you can all look round and feel special because you were here first. So, morning, everyone.
Morning.
That was nice. All right, guys. Well, we're here today. This is Tony Lee. He's a very special person. Now, Tony, I'll introduce you first. Now, Tony has written for, and you can correct me if I get any of this wrong, he has written for radio, television in the United States and in the UK, also for magazines, journalism, and of course, comic books as well. How many times have you won the New York Times bestseller?
I've been number one once, and I've been number two. That sounds really bad. my Doctor Who Star Trek got number two, and the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies got number one.
Excellent, and an Eagle Award as well.
Yep.
Excellent. And my name is Catherine, but quite a few of you know me as Caffers. This is Taylor, and we are from the Baker Street Babes. Right, so what we normally do when we have an interview with people, if you guys have listened to our podcast, you will know that we tend to ask people the babe questions. So I've actually prepared for you today, Tony, some of the babe questions. So this will initiate you as an unofficial Baker Street babe. We'll give you a badge, possibly a bikini as well.
Yeah, there were discussions of bikinis for a while.
So the questions, we ask these of everybody that we interview, and the first question is, really importantly, how did you first get into Sherlock Holmes?
When I was a kid, I was bullied a lot. I was about half the size of everybody else in my class, and if you held me up to a light, I looked like an X-ray. You can't believe that now, looking at me, I filled out in the wrong places. But when I was a kid, I was really skinny, and because of this, I'd go and find places to hide a lot during the school day. And one of the places was the school library. And I was a massive fan of Doctor Who, which obviously has taken me through all the way up to writing the Doctor Who comics and things like that. But the other thing I found was this character was Sherlock Holmes. And I can't remember the first book I read. I think the first one I read was actually, I think, The Valley of Fear. Oh, yeah. Something like that. I picked up some book and wanted to see what was going on. And I didn't really know much about it, but I sort of read the books. But I kind of fell into it more from the movies, because once I'd seen this character, and I saw a Basil Rathbone film came on, and I watched that, and a Pete and Dud movie was done, and I basically found my way through that. And then as I got older, I found that it was all a lie. It was all a lie about this Sherlock Holmes, and this poor, unfortunate Professor Moriarty was picked upon, and it was
Here
a massive smear campaign
Here
against him. But no, so, I got into it through the in a way from the books, but mainly through the films and the TV, and I mean, most people I know have sort of fallen into it because they found a Sherlock on TV, whether it be Brett or Cumberbatch or Robert Downey Jr. or whatever.
That's quite a nice segue into one of the other questions, which is... what is your favourite adaptation? So out of all the adaptations, you know, is it the first one that you saw, the Basil Rathbone, or is it perhaps one of the later ones?
I don't know, actually. I'm a massive fan of the Jeremy Bretts. I think the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes were brilliant. Although he is the worst detective in the world ever when he didn't realise that Watson had totally changed halfway through. My guilty pleasure is actually the young Sherlock Holmes, the Spielberg movie. And my wife will agree, I hope she wandered off and she's hiding from me somewhere. But we went to a Dracula Society dinner and Anthony Higgins was the guest, and he was there because he was also a Hammer actor as well, and he was collecting an award for on behalf of Benedict, and I was excited because he was Professor Raich in Young Sherlock Holmes, who is of course Professor Moriarty. So I was very excited about that. But I think my favourite of all of them probably still has to be Basil the Great Mouse Detective.
That is a big fan favourite.
Let's see, what else have we got? What is your favourite of the stories from canon? I know you said you started probably with Valley of Fear, so maybe a little out of order, but what's your favourite?
I'm really happy that they used this in the series, but one of my favourite ones is The Man with the Twisted Lip, which is it starts off with Watson finding Holmes in an opium den, which is where he usually finds him after a long night. I think that was one of my favourite ones. Valley of Fear, I think, was because that was my first one. The Red-Headed League has always been a popular one.
It's one of my
simple
favorites.
Fact is, the man is so stupid and deserves everything he got. I don't know, there's elements in every single one of them. I mean, there's obviously the ones with Mycroft in are great, the ones with Moriarty in are great. I think my favourite of all, though, probably still is Studying Scarlet, because it's the first one, it's the first
time. Yeah, that is a very good story. Now,
what about you? What's your favourite one?
Oh, Charles Augustus Milton. That's also because I'm a massive fan of any of you guys heard of Raffles and Amateur Cracksmen. Anyone in here? Some people nodding. Yes, some people know
what
it is. There's a person who knows what it is. Raffles and Amateur Cracksmen was written by an author called Hornung, who was actually a friend of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And I am convinced that Charles Augustus Milton, in part, is kind of a fan fiction of... Raffles, because they used to, because Raffles like parallels Sherlock Holmes like very well, and I think they did kind of make fun of each other like a little bit over it, because there's a lot of similarities, but it's a similar kind of, if you like the kind of friendship story but with crime, Raffles is like the other side of that. Now, what's your favorite, Taylor?
I'm actually a Red-Headed League fan. I love Red-Headed League. There's just something hilarious to me about any person who's like, oh, I can get paid a copy. Basically, it's the email scam of Victorian times. Look, I'm a prince and I need you to do this for me. But I don't know. That's pretty much my favorite. Although I like Speckled Band a lot too, which is, I think, the one that's always stuck out most in my mind.
It's a very good one. Now, this is an interesting question, actually, because it doesn't necessarily have to do with your favourite character, Tony, but which of the characters from the canon or like maybe from an adaptation would you want to have tea with, to have like a conversation with?
I think I know the answer to this.
Yeah,
Professor Moriarty. I would just sit there looking at me, so tell me more about how you're going to take over the world. Tell me more about that really good air gun you have. Please stop Moran staring at me like that. I'd actually like to have tea with Professor Moriarty, because you never actually hear Moriarty speak in any of the books. It's all like Sherlock Holmes went, oh, and then Moriarty said this, and I was like, yeah, whatever. And then we fell off a cliff. And then the next time he got some sort of show, I was like, oh, I went to his house and he wasn't there, so I went, bleh, at his pictures and stuff. So I'd actually like to have a conversation, because you might find that Moriarty's actually really badly Glaswegian or something. And you just don't know, and that's why he never spoke in the books, because Watson just didn't understand a single word he was saying.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, one of my favourite... sort of frightening adaptations of him is from the the Robert Downey Jr. second film, actually. He's very surprisingly sinister.
Jared Harris is absolutely amazing. You watch that and you just think, you've got no hope, Downey Jr. Your cute smile and your Devil May Care attire will not stop you this time.
It's like a little progression of the different Moriartys.
That's my favourite parade.
Are there any gyms today? Are you too embarrassed to put your hand up?
There's some,
yay!
There's a little cluster of gyms.
Is it like, what would you call it? What would be the collective noun for a group of Moriartys?
Ooh, I don't know.
What was that?
A collective noun for a group of Moriartys.
A Moriartians.
A Moriartians.
You
say whether you're a
Moriartian, you're a Moriartian.
A scum.
A scum of Moriartys. That's a good one. Right, now, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your Baker Street Irregulars comic book.
Yes.
Which, if you guys haven't read it, it came out in 2011, and it's about the period of time when Sherlock was supposedly dead. And obviously, it's Watson.
He's such a wacky scamster.
He's so terrible, isn't he?
Such a prankster.
So it's about what the way of the Baker Street Irregulars get up to solving crime in London whilst...
Yeah, well, basically, there's been like about a dozen different versions of the Baker Street Irregulars. You throw a stone somewhere in a bookshop, you're probably going to hear a book about the Baker Street Irregulars. But I was doing, myself and Dan Baldwood, who is also another massive Sherlockian, we were talking to Hachette Children's Books about, we wanted to do something to carry on from a series of 44-page graphic novels we've done for reluctant readers. And I'd said, I really want to do a teen group of like teenagers. And they were like, okay, well, who would you like to do? And I said, the Baker Street Irregulars. And they looked blankly at me, and they just didn't quite understand, because the thing about the Baker Street Irregulars is, although it's a term that everybody knows, nothing's really ever said about them, again, in the canon. Because in the canon, you know there's Wiggins, and that's it. And the only reason that you know Wiggins is his name is mentioned, like, I think, once or twice. Usually, the rest of it, it's just a whole load of dirty little street arrows who turn up out of nowhere and go, give us money, Gavner, and then off they go. So I thought, I want to do something with them. So we pitched an idea, which was basically, in the 3 years where Sherlock Holmes is believed dead, Watson, being utterly stupid, believes this. Everybody else knows it's a lie. Mycroft knows it's a lie. We've got Mycroft brings in somebody to effectively look after them. It's Irene Adler. She's brought in, and she knows it's a lie. Lestrade knows it's a lie, and that's quite impressive for Lestrade. But basically, the main one out of it is Wiggins. Wiggins knows it's a lie because Wiggins has been trained by Sherlock Holmes from the start. You know, he is his protege, he is his greatest student. This kid is going to know what's going on. And he turns around and says, look, you know, I know this is wrong. And there's a group of them. There's Wiggins, there's Pockets. Pockets is a girl, pickpocket, who you find out later on is a middle-class accountant's daughter and is trying to pretend to live the life. You've got Tiny, who's very tall, and Ash, his younger brother, who just is about 6 years old and is a chimney sweep and is quite mad and rides a very large dog called Fluffy. And then there's a girl called Eliza. And Eliza is the granddaughter of a detective that was one of Sherlock Holmes' peers. And in the first book, she's Wiggins' first client because her grandfather's kidnapped. And so there's a whole load of plots going through. And we've done four of them. We did four of them in 2011. And we did a page for the Times as well. The Times of London asked us to do a four-page story. But you've got basically the entire story is... each one is an adventure, but there's a mysterious masked guy whose name is M, and they can't work out if it's Moriarty or not, and they want to stop him and find out what's going on, and it all builds to a head. So it's actually it's now out of print almost, because Hachette, we're moving across to a US publisher now, so we're moving away.
Right.
And I believe there's some copies available in the hall, but it's now it's just been optioned as a stage play in America. And
that would
it's
be excellent,
been
actually.
Done by the first stage theatre company in America, and then it's going to go to basically across the world. So
brilliant.
That'd be fun. And it's great, and there's chases, and there's trains, and everything's factually accurate as well. For example, when we did a story involving the building of the Central Line and how they were going through the tunnels, and then we realised that the Central Line didn't turn up for 5 years. That was fun.
It's
all full of historical accuracy. But it's actually good, and there's a lot of Easter eggs for the Sherlockians, because it's actually a consulting editor for it was a guy called Leslie Klinger. And anybody who knows the name Leslie Klinger, this is the guy who wrote the annotated Sherlock Holmes, the most recent one, not the Baring Gould version. this guy knows everything about Sherlock Holmes, and he sat there and read through the scripts going, no, you can't do that! And so eventually when we got to the end, we went, okay, fine. But it was one of the best things I've ever done, the most enjoyable stories I've ever written.
It sounds fantastic. I wanted to ask you, actually, because one of the main characters is Wiggins. What did you feel about the portrayal of Wiggins in Series 3 of Sherlock?
Where is my wife? Wait, wave your hand, Tracy. I can't see you.
There
you are.
There she is.
My wife, yeah, she is. We literally, we were watching it, and the moment he turned up, we both went, Wiggins! Pointed at the TV screen, because it was like, yes! I'm over the moon, because obviously he's had his Baker Street Irregulars, he's had his Homeless Network. I just like the fact he's got his protege, he's got the Wiggins who turns up. And what was also nice is, because you've also got, there's Wiggins and there's Billy the footman. And the fact they kind of used them both into the same thing, I think was great. And I think that's also one of the reasons I like the sort of Baker Street Irregulars as well, because as a kid I was a big Charlie Chaplin fan. And obviously Charlie Chaplin's one of his first roles was playing Billy in the William Gillette Sherlock Holmes plays. So when he's like that tall. So.
Very nice.
And what in particular inspired you to go after the Irregulars? Like, what is the interest in side characters? Is that something specific here?
I think I like writing characters that you don't know much about. I mean, the thing is, I mean, although everybody's talked about Moriarty, and I've done stuff involving Moriarty, Moriarty is one of the biggest bad guys ever. He's the most famous nemesis ever. He's never spoken a word in the books. He's never really been mentioned apart from... I mean, Watson, again, is quite rubbish, because in the first thing he's like, there's this new guy called Moriarty, we've never heard of him before, now he's chasing us. Ah, no, Sherlock's dead, boo-hoo, feels. And then the next thing you know, she's going, oh, there was a story we wrote from about 3 years ago when we had tea with Moriarty, and he came by, and we petted his dog, and you're like, well, hang on a second, it's one or the other. You know, you either didn't know Moriarty or you did, but this is the guy who can't remember if he got shot in the shoulder or the leg, so it kind of falls in there. But I think the supporting characters you get to play with, because you know just enough about them. You knew, for example, Wiggins was helping Sherlock Holmes. His father could have been a criminal, and in the stories we actually go, what if Wiggins' father was working for Moriarty? Because then you've got Wiggins' dad working for Moriarty, Wiggins is working for Sherlock Holmes, maybe this is why Wiggins was thrown onto the streets, because, you know, he basically was going against his father's wishes, and all that kind of stuff builds in. And also we picked, there's several supporting characters from the stories that actually turn up. A certain Mr. Angel arrives at one point and is involved in the third and fourth stories. So you can play with these characters because there's less known with it. But I think a lot of the stuff I've done, I like to play with the people who are on the periphery, so to speak. Mm. So.
Yeah, I suppose you can say more about them as well, because they have a few like definitive characteristics, but then you can like expand on them and, you know, find out more about them through the adventures. We were quite interested in the way that you've used like gender representation as well in the Irregulars, because obviously like some of the pickpockets are girls, and then you've got Irene Adler who comes in as well. Was that like kind of a conscious decision? Or,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was very much a conscious decision, because we wanted to make sure that, you know, both markets, you know, both boys and girls wanted to enjoy it. But more importantly, is although we had Wiggins as the, you know, he's, as far as he's concerned, he is the greatest, you know, detective in Baker Street, while Sherlock Holmes is not in Baker Street. Eliza, who's the girl who is the client in the first story, but then becomes one of the Irregulars, she was trained by her grandfather, who was an equal. So, you know, they're constantly at hammer and tongs against each other, because he'll go, we're going to do this, and she's like, no, you're wrong. And then later on, he'll find out that he is wrong, and then he has to sort of go, whatever. And then Watson will go, oh my god, that's amazing, and then one dwarf.
Go and make some
tea. He did that a lot, didn't he? Let's be honest. Good God, Holmes, that's you! I didn't realise it was you with a funny moustache on. Good job I'm not in the army anymore. I will be dead.
How much time do we have left?
So can I just ask, are there any Watsonians in the audience? Oh, so sorry.
It's good that you guys are staying out of throwing distance, really.
Hang on, does someone just put their hand up who's a Watsonian and a Moriartyan? Yes, nicely done.
Alright, how long are I don't actually have a watch on today, but
we've got another 40 minutes.
Excellent. Well, I was going to ask you as well about the Confessions of Dorian Gray. Which is a big Finnish production, yes. I believe, yeah. And it had Nicholas Briggs, who we've actually interviewed before, comprising his role as Sherlock Holmes. Now, what was it that inspired you to write that, actually?
I wanted to write Nicholas Briggs as Sherlock Holmes, mainly. And they asked me to do a Dorian Gray thing, and I thought, ah. No, I mean, hands up here who listens a lot to The Big Finish. No, don't put your hand up when I say hands up here, because you might not know what my question is. Hands up here who listens to The Big Finish audios. Okay, hands up here who has no idea what The Big Finish audios are. Brilliant, okay. Basically, Big Finish are a company that do a lot of licensed audio plays and adventures. They do a lot of the Doctor Who stories, so if you want to hear more stories of the Sixth Doctor or the Eighth Doctor, they'll bring them in, and it's an audio adventure, which of course means that it doesn't matter how old the character, the actual actor is, they can play character 4. They do Blake 7, they did Stargate, they've done a whole lot of things. They just recently started doing Avengers. One of the things they started doing as well was they adapted some of the Sherlock Holmes stories and also created their new ones, like The Adventure of the Perfidious Mariner and things like that. And they've carried on. And what they're doing is they're continuing. Sherlock and Watson have got back together right before his last battle, and they're doing a series of sort of missed adventures around that time. This is when Sherlock is bearded, beekeeping Sherlock Holmes, who lives in Surrey. And we were doing a Confessions of Dorian Gray. Now, Confessions of Dorian Gray is another series that Big Finish did, where what they said was, what if Dorian Gray was real? And Oscar Wilde wrote the story and wrote the death to basically give an ending to the story, but Dorian Gray carried on. So you've got about 5 or 6 stories where it's different times in the world where Dorian Gray is wandering around and there's reasons why he's immortal and stuff like that. And I was given an opportunity to write the Christmas special. And they wanted a nice, light-hearted, kind of, at the same time, dark story. So I said, what about if we have it that Dorian Gray meets Sherlock Holmes? And the reason I wanted to use Sherlock Holmes is I use it, it's 20 years later on, he's beardy beekeeping Sherlock Holmes. Watson isn't in the story. Moriarty is, but surprisingly enough. But the whole point basically is that Sherlock doesn't come back to London anymore. And he's brought back to London because Mycroft can't get down to Surrey. They always have Christmas Day dinner together. So Sherlock comes up comes to London for that. At the same time, Dorian Gray, after 20 years being away, has returned for Henry Wotton's funeral. And while Dorian Gray is in the Langham Hotel, his painting is stolen. And Dorian Gray is basically told, you have got to publicly kill Sherlock Holmes in Piccadilly Circus on Christmas Eve, or we burn your painting. So the first thing Dorian Gray does is he goes to Sherlock Holmes and says, right, you're supposed to be the greatest detective of all time. Help me solve this case before I have to kill you. Because believe me, if it's you or the painting, I'm going to kill you. And of course, Sherlock Holmes says, I don't believe this supernatural stuff, you know, stuff and nonsense. But at the same time, all goes back to the... has a player who's read the book, the picture of Dorian Gray, first off? Excellent, okay. No. In that, Dorian basically screws over a friend of his called Alan Campbell, who is a chemist, and he sets him up for the death of Basil Hallward, who is the guy who painted the painting. I go back to that crime, because it was set at a time when Sherlock would have been around. So there must have been a reason why Sherlock didn't take that case on, or maybe Sherlock had an opinion on that case that wasn't correct. So it all goes back to that. So, and again, with the back characters, I've gone back into the backstory of all these characters. Dorian is trying to get his painting back. Sybil Vane has turned up again, saying that she's also immortal, and that Dorian never knew this. Sherlock, meanwhile, bumps into Moriarty in a house who looks no older than he was when they first arrived in Part 4. So all these things build up, and it's all, obviously, it's all wrapped up by the end of the story, and you'll go home for tea and medals, but yeah, it's one of my favourite audios I've ever written. Because, and I've written quite a few sort of Doctor Who bears and stuff like that, because I got to write a Sherlock Holmes story, but at the same time, it was the most supernatural thing I've ever sort of thrown something like that into.
And if people wanted to listen to us, where would they get it from?
You can download it from bigfinish.com. It's just come out as part of the Dorian Gray box set you can buy on Amazon. It stars Nicholas Briggs as Sherlock Holmes and Alexander Vlahos, who was Mordred in Merlin. He plays Dorian Gray. Moriarty is actually played by Leon, who was Rupert Young, thank you, who plays Sir Leon in it. It's great fun. it's lots of fun.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Are there any other particular things that you would like to do, like the crossover writing like that? Because I know that you've done like the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and things, but are there any other particular literary genres or characters that you would like to
I'm currently writing a comic called Crash Landing, which is effectively Dracula meets Flash Gordon.
That sounds amazing.
which is basically, the entire pitch is basically Dracula on a jetpack. And I mentioned it on Twitter, and Noel Clarke immediately came back and said, "You are not selling that to anybody. I'm going to have a chat with you about that." And that's just good fun. And that, we've really gone with that, because basically it's the illegitimate son of Quincy Morris and the nephew of Renfield are fighting vampires in 1924 London, when they fall through a wormhole and find Dracula, who is effectively Ming the Merciless, and the lost people of Atlantis, who are now this technologically advanced. I'm not joking, this is a story! I'm also doing one called Omerta, which is effectively a five criminal family of New York fighting elder gods. Which actually has a scene during the American War of Independence of George Washington punching out Cthulhu. it's great being a writer. This is something that I haven't told anybody, but I've been told I can say. The reason I'm not here tomorrow is because on Monday I fly to Los Angeles. I'm at the Gallifrey One convention next weekend, but during the week I've got meetings because I'm pitching two movies over in Los Angeles. But one of the things that we're going over with is a little while ago, I did a MacGyver graphic novel with the creator of MacGyver, Lee David Zlotoff, and the two of us kept in touch after that. And we've got a TV show in development that we're putting together, we're going into Los Angeles to talk about, called The Last Moriarty. And it's basically, I'm not going to say much about it, but it's effectively about, it's America, modern day America, and it's a guy who discovers that not only is he the last surviving male of the Moriarty line, but he's just inherited a centuries old criminal empire. And it's kind of like The Blacklist, but with Moriarty. And I get to say Moriarty lots in Los Angeles meetings, it's going to be great. So that's a big crossover thing we've done. But yeah, I think I like crossovers. I love playing with the idea of what would happen if so-and-so met so-and-so.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well, because is it easier to do things like that with comic books? Because there seems to be like a lot more freedom like in the writing of comic books, obviously because it's visual imagery, but you don't have to, the actors don't have to be like the age that they are, and you can do anything.
Yeah, I mean, radio and comics are the best things. If you're going to do a TV show or a movie, you've got a problem. If, you know, for example, I mean, if anybody's a Doctor Who fan and you saw the five-ish Doctors, or if you saw the
Five-ish
Doctors.
I hope everybody saw the Five-ish Doctors. Please, if you haven't, see it now.
But you've got, like, obviously, five, six, and seven wandering around. You've got four in the special. They've all got older as the years have gone. So if you wanted to do a crossover now, it's a lot harder, which is the problem they had with the 50th. But in a comic, you can. I mean, I've just done a TV... Oh, here you go. I've just finished my last Doctor Who comic, because IDW no longer have the license, and it's moving across the Titan. My last Doctor Who comic was... The Doctor and Clara go to Deadwood, 1882, where they meet Oscar Wilde and Calamity Jane, who were there at the time, who are hunting the zombied, petrified form of Wild Bill Hickok, who is shooting people with his finger because he's got this kind of supernatural power, but actually it's because he's actually controlled by the mind-controlled Thomas Edison, who is a puppet of aliens that are invading from the fifth dimension and want to destroy the Earth due to a connection to the Doctor that we don't know until episode 3. But the whole reason I did it was that in episode 3, I got to the scene where you've got all 12 Doctors standing there going, "Hello, we're the Doctor from Gallifrey, and we're very happy." And it's just this big one-page scene of all of them, and that's the only reason I did this massive crossover, just so we have all those Doctors, because you can't have that anymore in anything else apart from that.
Yeah, no, that is true. And there's also obviously writing for comic books and then writing for radio and then writing for television are all slightly different skills. Do you find it like quite easy to transfer between that, or does it involve like a bit of a brain shift?
It's getting easier.
Yeah.
it's getting a lot easier. I mean, there's a way I talk to this. I do a lot of talks with people who are novelists who want to write comics, or screenwriters who want to write comics, or comic writers who want to write screenplays. And I use a thing called my James Bond conversation, which is basically, I say, it's a simple scene. James Bond's walking down a corridor, he sees that his door is open. It's a hotel room corridor. He sees his door is open. He goes in through the door. He's got a suite with a bedroom, main room, and bathroom. So he goes in, he pulls out the gun, goes in. There's nobody in the front room. There's nobody in the bedroom. He sees the bathroom door is closed. You then got this cut scene where you're now staring at the window door as he kicks the door in and is shocked at what he sees. Cut. So it's a very simple scene. You know, corridor, door, gun, kick, stare, shock. If you're doing a film is, say, about 100 minutes long. If you're doing a book is about 100,000 words long. If you're doing a graphic novel, it's about 100 pages long. If you did that same scene in three different types of story, each one would differ. Because you wouldn't use more than a minute of a show to show the scene, because nothing actually happens. He doesn't speak any lines. And at the end, you don't even see what he finds in the bathroom. It could be a towel on the floor. We don't know. James Bond might have an OCD phobia about towels on floors. Think about it. That might be why he went absolutely mad during Goldfinger when he finds him in the bed and the towel's covered in gold. So, that's 100 minutes on a film. If you're writing a book, 100,000 words, you're not going to spend more than maybe a page on that story. Maybe three pages tops. So again, you're looking at no more than 1%. But if you're doing a graphic novel, that entire scene has to be done in one page if you're going to keep the same percentage. So because of that, being a comic writer helps as a screenwriter because you're used to pulling everything out. You're used to taking all the rubbish stuff that you don't need. For example, if James Bond's walking down a corridor, he sees his door is open, and the next scene he's walking into the room with a gun in his hand, you're not going to read this and go, well, wait, hang on, where'd that gun come from? Because you pretty much know he's going to have pulled it out. Your mind will naturally do that. It's the same that when you're watching something like The Mentalist, and they have a crime and they go from their place to where it's happening. I don't know if you've ever looked at maps of California, but that's a four-hour drive they've just done to get to this crime scene. He does it five times in an episode. They spent a week just going backwards and forwards. You know, so a lot of that is that's the best thing about it, is it helps to know all of them. But I think the comic thing helps with the screenwriting. Neither of them really help with the writing of novels, I'll be utterly honest. That kind of throws me a bit.
Now, if you were, that's like a really nice sort of succinct way of putting the difference there. But are there any kind of aspiring writers in here right now?
I will kill you. Line up.
Is there any advice that you think you could sort of give, like general piece of advice?
Give up.
He's a lovely person, really.
Okay, so Hans is an aspiring writer. Okay, let me see your hands. Hands down. Hands up, who's an aspiring screenwriter? Okay, hands up, who's an aspiring novelist? Of those novels, now someone put their hand up and they put it down really quickly. Put your hand up again if you're an aspiring novelist. Now keep your hand up if you're an aspiring novelist who has written slash or fanfic.
Keep them up.
Good.
Keep them
That's
up.
Good, okay. I was going to say, if you want to be a writer, you've got to write. David Morrell, who wrote First Blood, always used to say in his talks, he'd say, why do you want to be a writer? And the first person would say, oh, I want to be rich. Never going to happen. Why do you want to be a writer? I want to be famous. Never going to happen. You know, think about it. Name half the people. Think of your favourite movie. Think of who directed it. Then think of who wrote it. Yeah, good plan. It's because you've got to write. You've got to get these ideas out of your head. I mean, my wife, again, she also say it. I literally, 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day, I'm sitting there writing stuff down or having ideas or bouncing around. You can't stop. So if you are a writer, you'll know that you're a writer because you're always writing. Even if you're not publishing it, or even if no one's buying it, you're still writing. And keep those things, because you don't know when you're ever going to use them. I mean, 7 of the stories I wrote in my Doctor Who stories were stories I wrote when I was 13, 14 years old, and never used, and then put them elsewhere. The Sherlock Holmes and Dorian Gray story was based on an idea I had 5 years earlier for something utterly different. I mean, Flash Gordon meets Dracula, I've had for a long time. You know, and you will always have the opportunity to do it, but always keep writing. And if you've got some honest friends, and I mean honest friends, don't give it to your mum. Your honest friends who will turn, unless your mum's really evil, then that's fine. But give it to someone who will just go, this is great, but I really hated this entire section here. Because you need someone who's going to teach you how to rewrite. Because the one thing you need to know more than anything else as a writer is that you're going to be rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. I've just finished a book, it's a middle grade book, Again, cool, young Moriarty. That's gone through something like 8 rewrites before it's gone back out to publishers, purely because of notes. So you will always, always be rewriting. And I do a lot of talks at schools, and when I say, even hint that they might have to take that one 500-word story they just wrote today and change it, they look at me like I've just killed their puppies. Because in their mind, they're thinking, no, I wrote the end, that means it's done forever. So if you want to be a writer, you've got to write. And don't be scared to go back and kill things off and change things around. Delete entire chapters for the hell of it to see what happens.
That was beautiful, thank you.
And if you want to write in comics or TV or anything like that, we'll form an audio queue later on and I will find a weapon of my choice and we'll discuss it.
I think that we were going to open it up for a Q&A from the audience. See if they have some questions that we might not have.
You can ask us questions as well.
Yes, you can ask any of us questions. There's a microphone in the very center, so if you just go up to the microphone.
Yeah, in fact, guys, if some of you weren't here earlier, if you want to ask a question, you have to line up at the microphone.
Hang on a second, is that microphone a wireless microphone? Right, somebody stand up, a young and fit. You, little boy. Hello, stand up. You are now the wielder of the microphone. And you grab that microphone, you run over to the people, and you give them the microphone.
You now have the power.
You have power.
You have the power.
Be aware.
Give a round of applause, everyone.
Oh, has he not been allowed to do that? Oh, okay, that's good. You must wait, wielder of the microphone. Be patient. One day it will be yours. Right, hello.
Hi, sorry, I've just got one question.
What's your name?
I'm Johanna.
Hello, Johanna. Are you enjoying the weekend?
Yes, very much.
That's good.
I'm mostly writing because I'm doing an animation course, so I have to come up with scripts, so it's very new to me. But what I've found so far is that most of the books on screenwriting are for an American audience. Like, I've just read a story by The Key, which is...
Oh, God, don't tweet that! No, that's what you use to kill other writers. It's the size of a brick.
But what's the main difference between writing for a British audience and writing for an American?
There really isn't one. I mean, there's format differences. So, for example, if you're writing an American TV show, you need a teaser, and then there's like 5 acts, and things go through, and you always need these breaks. To be honest, though, I mean, there's a lot of books out there that you can spend a lot of money on to teach you how to write, and that's great. And these books, these people, you can spend hundreds of pounds to go along to teach how to write. But 9 times out of 10, all they're trying to teach you is how to tell a story. And if you're a writer, the chances are you know how to tell a story. There were 2 books that I tell anybody who wants to be a screenwriter to buy. One of them is called How Not to Write a Screenplay. And it might sound a bit negative, but it's actually not written by a screenwriter. It's written by one of the guys who reads your scripts. And this guy's gone, over the years, I've read hundreds and hundreds of scripts. These are the things that really annoy me. And you read it, and it's the nuts and bolts of writing, and that's a lot better. It shows things like, if you're doing a flashback, this is how you do a flashback. If you're doing a montage, this is how you do a montage. And the other one is called Save the Cat. And it's by a guy called Blake Snyder. And that one's brilliant, because it goes more into why your character would do this. And it's things like, for example, reasons why a character that might be dislikable will suddenly stop a kid being beaten up, or will save a cat. Purely so you have that one moment you go, oh, he's not all that bad, really. It's, who watches The Walking Dead? Right, it's the Daryl syndrome. Daryl, oh, he's a bit bad boy, but oh, he helped her when she was sad. Done, instant hero. There's that kind of thing. So there are 2 things I would say. There isn't much difference between UK and US. Half the scripts I've sent over to America have been looked at, and it's not much of a change.
Thank you. All right, wielder of the microphone.
Wielder of the microphone. Pick someone with their hand up. Put your hand up and the wielder will choose you.
You have to keep your hand up.
Run, wielder, run! Run, be free!
Hi, Tony.
Hello.
My name's Nick. Tony, one of the things I enjoy most about the short paper stories are the cunning expositions where things works it out from the various clues that were available. Is that one of the hardest parts for you, if you're writing something involving Sherlock Holmes, or is that the most fun bit?
Yeah, because the thing with that is, I mean, there's several times when Wiggins has to prove himself, because obviously he's in a market where nobody wants to deal with him, and you know, people look at him and go, you're just like a 14-year-old kid, go away. So he'll then have to go, oh, well, actually, I can see that you're walking with a limp, because your shoe is slightly smaller than the other, which means this, and they go into it, and of course, Watson will go, good God, Wiggins! It was just like Holmes was in the room! I am so sorry what so needs. But the thing is that it's the same thing that Conan Doyle did, is you don't work it out. You work out the answer and you work out, well, how did that happen? And when you know you can go backwards, it's a lot easier. Because you can literally just go, right, so I know this is the answer, how does it get there? And in fact, most of the stories I write, I'll start with a scene and go, how do you do that? And it's kind of like the game you play with, well, you didn't play the game, but when you were a kid, if you had a little child that you had to play with, like a younger brother or sister or something like that, it's the game where you go, I'm just going down to shops, and they go, why? I'm going to some chocolate. Why? Because I'm hungry. Why? Shut up. Why? That game? That's what we play with ourselves. And if you're sitting there doing that with a crime, it's brilliant. And you can really work out. I mean, some of the stories I did in The Mystery of Ignis are, even I was looking at going, oh, wow, okay, yeah, that works. And sometimes, because you've worked out something else, it will fall in your lap quite nicely. So it is one of the hardest things to do, but if you know how it's going to end, it makes it a whole lot easier, if that makes sense. Run. Run, there's one at the front. There's one at the front. There's a hand at the front. Run, run to the front. Come, boy, run. Run. Let him through. He is an important man with a microphone.
Shall pass.
You could have just run to the front and passed it over. That's okay. I didn't want to tell you that until you got there.
It's a learning experience.
Make something up and then go back and research it.
No, no. Again, my wife will know that I buy loads of rubbish books about various things. I've just done I've just pitched a TV show about Dick Turpin, and I went and found everything I could possibly find about Dick Turpin, which actually isn't much, because Dick Turpin was a really nasty person who no one wanted to write about, and it was really difficult finding every little bit. But the moment you find one tiny piece of research that makes you go, oh, I can use that, then that's your little grail, that's your holy grail. And because of that, if I'm doing something that, I mean, especially if I'm doing an actual existing thing, like with Doctor Who, one of my biggest complaints was that I was always a bit too fan-friendly because I threw everything into the stories. But that's because I suddenly realised that, if you do this and this happens and then this can go through and, oh, there's a character that could do that, why create a new alien when I could use an old alien? And the research will work that through. But yeah, I mean, there's a whole load. I mean, on the Sherlockian side, I pitched a radio play ages ago called Oscar and Arthur, and it's about this is actually a true, absolute true story. Some of you might not know this. Oscar Wilde and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had dinner together at the Langham Hotel on August 31st, 1889, and this was basically a dinner where Henry Stoddart of Lippincott's Magazine was basically was courting them to write for his new magazine in America. And Conan Doyle turned up wanting to effectively do a serialization of what is called The White Company, which is a very strong historical novel he wrote. Conan Doyle wanted to, Oscar Wilde wanted to do a book called The Fisherman and the Sea. And during this one evening, where it was Conan Doyle, Oscar Wilde, Lippincott's Stoddart, and an MP, an Irish MP, during this dinner, Conan Doyle decided that instead of doing The White Company, he was going to write the second Sherlock Holmes book. And at the time, Sherlock Holmes was a character he hated. Because Study of Scarlet was a commercial failure. The company that did it didn't do it right, it was put badly, he didn't enjoy it, he didn't want to do it. But he walked out going, I'm going to do another Sherlock Holmes. And Oscar Wilde walked out going, I'm going to do The Portrait of Dorian Gray. So this one meeting brought, you know, basically, you know, the sign of four and Richard Dorian Gray into this world. So I wanted to do what happened that night, a dramatisation of that night. There was one line in a diary, and that's it. And I've researched everything, because it's those sort of things just won't come out that time. So there is a point where you go, I've got as much research as I can possibly get. But I know from other dinners that he's been to, he would have done this. I know from other conversations he's done, he would have done this. So you kind of have to merge it all together and have to play around. But no, research is key. I mean, I did a book a while ago where I actually had a heist at the British Museum, 1845. So I went to the British Museum Library, and I was actually in the British Museum in their Hamilton Library, going through the old records and finding out what it looked like, and in the process learning that there was like a jeweller's tunnel and there was other things being built at the time, so all these things fell into it. At the same time, I did learn when that was going on that the Drury Lane Theatre had been burned down like five times and there was five different theatres, which then became the basis of the second Baker Street of Inquiries book. So research is always good because you never know when you're going to need it next.
Thank you very much.
Oh, pass it across. But you must now run to the end and run around. Are you sitting on someone's lap now? Oh, I stole the seat. Okay, that's it. I was going to say, well done, my child. Hello, Patricia.
I was wondering if you ever acted. You seem very animated and personable, and did this help? And one other quick thing about Sherlock Holmes, the Arthur Conan Doyle characters are they in public domain, but you have to pay someone.
this is just
come out recently. I did go to drama school when I was younger, but I left after a term. And I was a Covent Garden street performer when I was in my early 20s, and I had an accident that paralysed me. Believe it or not. No, seriously, I had an accident. No, I'm not joking. I actually had an accident. If you ever go to my website, which is tonylee.co.uk, every children in need, I do a big thing about it because I was paralysed, and Pudsey saved my life. It was basically there was a guy being Pudsey, and I was in a really bad state, and I just latched onto this guy. Which probably made his day really happy, but but because of that, because I was paralysed, I couldn't do anything else. I was writing. I went back into writing. I wrote for Radio 4 Weekending, which is a typical a weekly show, and then I just carried on with writing after that. But my ego knows no bounds, so I will quite happily chat to anyone on stage. As for the Sherlock Holmes thing, though, that's something that's only just. Yeah, my mistake. There was also my short-lived stint as Iron Man. Someone's been looking at Tumblr. There's worse. So, no, there really is. No, the Sherlock Holmes thing has recently just been sorted out. As I've said before, there's a guy called Leslie Klinger, and Leslie Klinger has been fighting for ages because one of the reasons why Sherlock Holmes, the Baker Street of Inquiries, had problems with Hachette was when we went to go to America, the Conan Doyle estate went, no, sorry, we own everything to do with Sherlock Holmes, you can't do this, it's still within copyright. What it actually is the last five stories are still within copyright. So in America, if you're using character over here, nobody really cares. It's not really that fast. But in America, they're really onto it. They want to get as much money as possible. The Downey Jr. movie gave me some money, and from that point onwards, they've just gone for anything. But the problem was, the last five books are public domain. Which means that if you're using characters from those last five books, then you've got a problem. And of course, Holmes is in those last five books. I mean, Watson is in it. So you've got those two characters. But there's like 50 books beforehand where the characters are created. So there was an argument that if you're using these characters, the things that we would be using would all have been done in the public domain books. Moriarty's public domain, Irene Adler's public domain, Lestrade's public domain, all these other characters are public domain. But there's been a contest for ages, and literally, I think it was about 2 months ago, Leslie Klinger won the case, which meant that you can now sell anything involving Sherlock Holmes out there. I think it's still a bit of a dodginess about saying Sherlock Holmes, because I think there's a trademark issue on there. But basically, yeah, it became a situation. You can now go out and say, this is set during this time, therefore it's a public domain book, therefore I can now write this story. And it's one of the reasons why the Baker Street of Inquiries is now being made as a play, because of the fact that we had to wait until that was being done.
Thank you. That's what I was wondering. So I guess Sherlock, BBC had no problem with that.
No, because in the UK, the copyright law is slightly different, so they didn't have to answer, really. I don't know if they
also, at the same time, though, there's a different thing, because it's called Sherlock, not Sherlock Holmes. But also, it's not... He's in the 19th century, he's got hansom cabs, he's got an opium issue.
We might still have an opium issue.
But in those days, opium was, hey kids, have some opium.
Thank you so much.
If you want to know more about it, Google Leslie Klinger and obviously the Charlotte case. Yeah, it's very interesting reading. I think even you guys have done it on your site.
The hashtag on it was Free Sherlock, and I know that we have some writing up about it.
Yeah,
on the Baker Street Babes website, too, there's an article about it, which is kind of interesting. So, I mean, we also had a big problem in the States because the copyright, there's even an argument as to who owns the Doyle estate. There are different people who are kind of
there's a lot of lawyers getting money. That's the
basically.
Reason.
I think the only winners here are the lawyers in this case.
Hi, Tony.
Wow, that was amazing. You got that without even looking. That's a good job, microphone boy. Unfortunately, you guys over there, he's settled down now. Yeah, get ready, microphone boy. There's people over here who want to hurt you, so get ready.
I appreciate writing and making my own book series because I'm actually more of a drawer than a writer.
Artist.
Artist.
Go with the term. If you go to a publisher and say, hello, I'm a drawer, they don't often hire you. So you're an artist who is also writing your own stories?
Yes.
Die.
He means that in the most loving way.
I was just wondering, when you write for comics, do you keep in mind sort of from the very beginning how it's going to look when it's made out of page, or is that something you do in rewrites?
There's two types of ways of doing it. You'll probably do it the same way that Marvel will do it, which is basically someone will go, you know, James Bond walks down a corridor, sees a door bursting through the room, and then you draw it as you see it. I write it as a script, so I'll say, page one, we're looking at Sherlock. James Bond as he's walking down a corridor with Sherlock. Panel two, that's the next slash fiction there for you. James Bond in a hotel with Daniel Craig. And it's mixed scene by scene. But I don't actually say, I want this to be a long panel, I don't want it to be a large page or something like that. I will just say, this is four panels on this page. I trust my artists that they can draw what I'm asking for. And it has bit me badly in the past. I mean, Daniel Warford, who did the Baker Street Regulars books, Sam Hart, who did my Heroes and Heroines books, some of my best friends, you know, they're really great. Matt Dow-Smith, Josh Adams, people like that who've done my Doctor Who stories, Mike Collins, who did the last ones. I've known Mike for a good decade, and we know each other. I know that, you know, for example, I know Dan Borwood hates drawing horses, so I made the entire third book about horses. Artists who can draw. But I did a Doctor Who story for the 10th Doctor where I forgot to mention that the brand new alien race I'd created, called the Enochians, who are kind of these clockwork angels, were human-sized. And it was just something I just hadn't assumed for, because every time you watch a Doctor Who episode, they're always human-sized. But the artist drew them as 25 foot high, which was fine, until you realise it in the final part, the Doctor has to pilot their spaceship. And then suddenly the entire episode had to be him finding chairs and ladders and stuff. So you then had to go back and put chairs and ladders in places so he knew where they were later on. So it didn't look like your artist had drawn 20 foot high aliens. So it can be fun, but I like to make sure my artists can basically get as much as they can out of it. And often, I mean, with Dan and people like that, I will sit down with them before. I mean, Dan created every single piece of the Baker Street Regulars with me from scratch. You know, we worked it all out. And so, you know, everything that I wrote was also because of what he was putting together, so I knew what he could do. But as if you're doing artists that you're doing, right, keep doing it, keep trying it. Stop doing pin-ups, do sequentials. Editors want to see sequentials, they don't want to see pin-ups.
Thank you very much.
Right, should we have someone on the side of the room?
Run, microphone boy, come on,
yeah.
Run!
Does
anyone
want to
ask a question on this
side?
Yeah, there's a couple of people.
Hurry, just stand on them. Just climb over their laps.
You are in charge.
Choose wisely.
Hello, my name is Christine. I died a little when you said that you write sort of the ending first and then go backwards, because my problem has always been the moment that I know where my story is going.
Oh, I don't write the ending. I'll be about two-thirds of the way through the story, and then I'll work my way back, and then by the time I get back to that point again, it's utterly different.
I'm having the how things work.
Okay.
My problem has always been that I lose interest in the story as soon as I find out how it's done. Do you have any tips?
Oh, I see. Yeah, was it? That's a tough one, because I know a lot of people who read mystery books, and they love to know the mystery, and they hate to know how it ends. But if you're writing a mystery, you kind of need to. Otherwise, it doesn't really help writing the mystery. The way you could do it, and I know people who do it, is they will actually go, I'm going to write a mystery about this, and there will be a blank page one start. And as they learn, they'll just basically see how it goes. And there's several times I've had people going, I didn't expect that person to be the murderer. Because when I started it, I had that person doing something else. But their character spoke to me in a different way. So you can't do it both ways. It's just I'm too controlling to do that. Because I would worry too much about the fact that I would get confused with that, if that makes sense. I'm so sorry. No, I mean, I obviously, you don't have to start the book at the end. You can actually start at the beginning.
Okay.
Or in the middle. Or after they're all dead.
All right, any more questions?
We've got time for a couple more.
Yeah, we've got a couple more minutes, I think.
Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry if this has been asked, but I was too busy outside buying a book.
Good answer. Yeah. Wow, is that Doctor Who and Star Trek The Next Generation, the complete hardcover edition? Ah, oh, excellent. Is that the one where the 11th Doctor and Picard have scenes together?
Spoilers.
Yeah.
Trigger for actually putting those two together in that.
It wasn't any, actually, in fairness, it's a really bad answer because it wasn't anything to do with me. I was brought on board after they'd already got it sorted out. Scott and David Tipton wrote it. I was brought on board for the first four books and worked with them on it. But they've been trying to do Star Trek and Doctor Who for ages, and I know they've been hitting the BBC and being told no, and hitting people being told no, and eventually one day someone walked up to Stephen Moffat at, I think, Comic Con and said, look, why can't we do this? And Moffat went, wow, that sounds awesome, let's do it. And then suddenly it was happening. So, but there was a lot of, there was, the biggest problem was it sounds great and fun and wonderful, but the issue was is you had BBC and CBS both wanted to have the last word. So what happened is BBC, so the BBC, this is it. Well, BBC would say, we're done, we're happy, it's sorted. And then CBS would go, one last thing. And then BBC would go, oh, well, we've got one last thing too. And then CBS would go, oh, really? Well, we've got one more thing. And then suddenly you've now 5 weeks behind. So it was a fun book to do, but I'm quite glad we're never doing it again. Although, it's never going to happen now because IDW lost the license, but I was we were pitching a sequel, which was the Doctor and Clara turning up on Deep Space Nine during a Jem'Hadar and Sontaran invasion. And that one was fun, because that had the Doctor going off and meeting the original Enterprise, and you had Clara with Major Kira. It was brilliant. Never going to happen. It's going to be my fanfic forever. See, I told you, you write fanfic as a writer, no matter what.
Right, any
more? Time for one last
question.
One last question.
Maybe he's over there. Over there.
Behind you. Come on, Wiggins, run!
Hi, my name's Katrina. I'm really interested in the long writing you were doing, say, in the Victorian era, particularly the Baker Street and the Regulars, and your Oscar Wilde in The Wild West, which I absolutely love the idea of. But when you're writing stories such as that in that era, do you stick with the bleakness of the time, or do you take much more of a steampunk twist?
Oh no, it's incredibly bleak. It's incredibly bleak. I mean, I grew up reading things like Charles Dickens and Oliver Twist and stuff like that. One of my first books I actually wrote was a book which was Oliver Twist and the Dodger getting back together after 12 years. So I kept in that kind of that pocket. Going back to the question of research, I literally went through so many books, the sketches on bars, all those sort of stories of Victorian times. I've got a map of London from 1843 that is so detailed, you can literally go straight into each individual street. So when you see me saying he went down this street, down here, cut across here, it's actually how he would have done it. You know, I love that era. I just really want to write it. I don't go for the steampunky side because it's a weird thing. Although I'm writing imaginary characters doing imaginary things, I want to try and keep it steeped in the same reality that it did at the time. Because you've got to remember that when Conan Doyle wrote Sherlock Holmes, it was contemporary. It was effectively CSI. It was a modern day procedural crime drama on a weekly basis or a monthly basis. So I want to try and keep it as close to that as possible. That said, I've got nothing against doing steampunk type stories. I've written a couple in my time, but usually, even when I've got Doctor Who fighting Jack the Ripper, which we did before the TV show did, we actually still kept it pretty real, even though he was an alien lizard creature.
Thank you very much.
There's the whiny sound. I think that's time to end.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much, Tony. It was a pleasure to have you here, and you guys have been really wonderful. Thank you for all the lovely questions.
Can you please give a massive round of applause to the Bakersfield Babes?
Thank you.